right, I am going to call to order today's meeting of the Faculty Senate on Wednesday, November 20th, 2024. Liz, who's stepping in today, do we have a quorum?
Yes, we do.
Great. That brings us up to item 3, adoption of the agenda for today's meeting. Can I have a motion to adopt today's agenda? All right, Arado and Scott, stalk up a second. All in favor of adopting the agenda for today's meeting, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, our agenda is approved, or is adopted, I suppose. All right, up next is the approval of the October 30th, 2024 minutes. Those are on pages 3 through 5 of your packet. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes? Thank you, Felicia, and a second. Virginia, thank you. Is there any discussion on the minutes? All right, seeing none, nobody moving towards mics. All in favor of approving the October 30th, 2024 minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? All right, our minutes are approved. Liz, do we have any public comment today?
We have not received any requests for public comment.
Great. All right, so moving right along, that brings us to item 6, which are Faculty Senate President's announcements. I'm going to be brief with my announcements today, as we have a fairly full agenda. I've only got 2. The first is I want to remind folks that represent groups that will have an open Faculty Senate seat starting in fall 2025 to help work within either your unit or your constituency group to help recruit somebody into this position. It's really a key university level service opportunity, and I really hope we continue to build a deep bench of folks who are committed to shared governance and contributing to the work of the Faculty Senate. We're encouraging elections to take place in the upcoming weeks, and we've reached out to department chairs and schools that have openings. But we do hope that you all go back and remind folks that those elections we're hoping to have no later than early January or no later than January, so we can have that full slate by mid-February. And that'll help us put together committees and make plans for the work in the upcoming academic year. I know that's a long ways away, but it's also right around the corner. The second item I have is related to what I started last session about sharing some of the behind the scenes or the non-known work that's going on campus or through this body. I wanted to share today about the development, kind of a longer term project to develop a single place to find university procedures related to the Faculty Senate bylaws. The intention is to allow committees to work more efficiently, improve continuity over the years, and allow for procedures to be reviewed and improved as necessary. I'm grateful to the Faculty Senate, University Council, Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee for taking on the foundational work for this, where they're going to be categorizing, looking through our bylaws to see where procedures ought to exist or they likely exist. And then once that work has been completed, I'll be working with the various bodies of the Faculty Senate to collect the various procedure documents that are in place or to coordinate the development of procedures that are implied. If you have those on hand and you want to get ahead of the game, feel free to reach out to me and send them along. Otherwise, I'll be reaching out later on with specific asks. And again, the hope is to produce a systematic way that to elevate and make available our procedures on campus related to the Faculty Senate. So that concludes my announcements. So that brings us to item 7, which is the provost announcement. So I'll invite up Provost Elish Piper.
There we go. Now it's working. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. I want to remind everyone it's that time of the semester that we need to do book adoptions for spring. Book adoptions were due last week, due the last week of October, but we still have a lot of them that have not yet been submitted. So if you can please take that message back to your colleagues and encourage them to do so as quick as possible. You can do that within the Follett Discover textbook adoption area in Blackboard is the most efficient way to do that. And we want to make sure that students have access to those texts when classes begin. I also want to give you a little update. Alicia Shadiman had shared the EdSites AI texting program that we had launched or we're going to launch. And I want to let you know that we did launch it and that we had 10,172 students who received those text messages. And only a very small fraction of students have opted out. The idea behind this is to connect with students and help them if they need resources or information, if they're struggling with things, if they have questions that they don't know what the answers are, and it sits on top of Navigate. So we've been very pleased since we launched it on November 6th that we've had just about 1% of students who have opted out, and most of them were seniors. And so it seems like most students are opted in. And the most recent question that we asked students was about their plans to return in the spring. And we were able to identify 222 students who said that they had barriers to being able to return in the spring. And so we've been able to have the appropriate people on campus reach out to those students to try and provide support or information or assistance with addressing those barriers to students being able to re-enroll. And so we're very excited that the launch of EdSite seems to be going well in terms of providing another mechanism for supporting our students and their success. Faculty nominations for students for the 25-26 Newman Civic Fellowship Program offered by the Campus Compact are now available if you go to the OCL website. So if you can think of students who might benefit from this year-long program focused on civic and community engagement, those nominations will be accepted until December 6th, and then students have until January to complete the application if they are nominated. So if you're interested, you can go to the OCL website. Want to remind everyone it's International Education Week. Some of you may have attended some of those events. There are a lot of others on the campus calendar. So if you haven't had a chance to look at those, you may want to see if there are events that you're interested in attending for the remainder of the week. As the semester approaches the end, we know that commencement is around the corner. So I have some commencement reminders for you. If you have not RSVP'd for the for an undergraduate ceremony, those RSVPs are supposed to be submitted by today. But usually there's a little bit of flexibility if people are a little bit late on that and want to attend. Sunday, December 15th at 10 a.m., we'll have our first undergraduate ceremony. That's for the College of Engineering and Engineering Technology, College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and College of Visual and Performing Arts. The second undergraduate ceremony is also Sunday, December 15th. It begins at 2 o'clock, and that's for the Colleges of Business, College of Education, and College of Health and Human Sciences. If you are interested in attending the graduate ceremony, you can RSVP up until December 1st. And that ceremony is on Saturday, December 14th at 2 o'clock. And so I look forward to seeing a lot of you and your colleagues at commencement. I know that when students have an opportunity to see the faculty who have made a significant impact on their degree completion, they really enjoy that opportunity at commencement. So I look forward to seeing folks there. That concludes my announcements.
All right, thank you. So moving right along, that brings us up to item 8, which are items for faculty Senate consideration. We have two different items today. The first up is the Annuitants Association presentation by Tony Tollerud and Terry Borg. So I will turn it over to them for their presentation.
Thank you very much. You can call me Hopalong today. My name is Dr. Tony Tollerud. I'm a retired faculty, and if you asked me when I retired, I'd have to say I'm not sure because I retired 3 times. Somebody got it. but anyway, I'm very glad to be here today, and currently I am the president of the Northern Illinois University Annuitants Association, and I'm going to let Terry introduce himself in a minute, but I'm a proud person who spent most of my time here in the Department of Counseling, Adult and Higher Education, which may have a new name now, I'm not sure. And then I spent a couple of years in the Dean's office, and it was delightful. It was a great place to be, And I came to NIU in 1990, was going to stay a year, and voila, I'm still here. So I hope that NIU is as good to you as it has been to me through my journey as an educator and professor. Terry, you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Terry Borg.
Hi, my name is Terry Borg, and I am the vice president of the NIU Nutrients Association. I retired, I think, about 2 or 3 years ago. It's funny how time passes much faster when you retire. And the fact is, as I look around the room, I see many old friends here that will probably one day retire as well.
So just to get us started, how many of you currently are annuitants members? Would you raise your hand? Oh, that's not good. That's not good. Okay, thank you. How many of you are tier one retirees? Okay. And then those of you that are tier two. Okay. Well, the best way to start out talking about the annuitants is that the Annuitants Association is for everyone. And so we're hoping today to leave you with enough information that you might consider joining the annuitants here. It's a very worthy organization. While it's kind of in the background, it's always active on our behalf as retirees and current faculty and staff from this institution. They're always working for us, trying to get us the best they can in our retirement packages, as well as insurance. We have a very large lobby that lobbies for legislation that helps universities and our pension plans and anything else that has to do with us. So it's a worthy organization to belong to. So that's just my beginning words, but Terry's going to talk a little bit about what NIU is, NIUAA is, and what it's about.
So great. So you should be thinking about this purely from a self-interest point of view. And it's really about you and your colleagues that you need to think about this, because someday, whether it's from here or someplace else, you're going to retire, whether you want to or not. So I want to share with you a little bit about the NIU Annuitants Association in terms of how it can serve you and how it is serving you right now. So to get started and kind of level the playing field, I want to give you some definitions. So as I go ahead and talk today, you may not be confused. First of all, the NIU Annuitants Association is one of 53 chapters in the state of Illinois of something called the State University Annuitants Association, or more affectionately known as SUA. So if you're a member of the NIU Annuitants Association, you become a member automatically of SUA. And SUA membership is, as Tony indicated, is for both current employees along with retirees. So when I worked at NIU, I was a NIU Annuitants Association member for probably around 15 of my 21 years here. It's important to also note that the NIU Annuitants Association, our chapter alone, is the largest chapter of all the chapters in the state of Illinois. It means it's bigger than UIC's, and it's bigger than University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana as well. So let's talk about SUA for a minute, since that's really the mother organization, and that's really where you get most of your services from. SUA's sole purpose is to promote and protect the interests of the participants in the state university retirement system. So immediately you may be thinking, ooh, okay, SERS, the traditional plan, I'm not part of the traditional plan, I'm not going to be interested in this. But as I speak a little bit later, you're going to find out how you are of interest, you will be interested in this, because again, it does serve your interests, even if you're in what's known as the self-managed or portable plan, or also the defined contribution plan. So while SERS administers the pension part of your program, SUA advocates for us. We've already referred to tier one and tier two employees. Many of you know what that means, but tier one employees, those people employed before January 1st, 2011. Tier two employees are those that got employed within the university system or the state of Illinois employee system after January 1st, 2011. And that's important because Tier 2 employees currently get less retirement benefits than Tier 1. And we're going to talk about that in a moment as well. And usually, you know, I always have to wait until the end of a spiel to find out what's this going to cost me. And I, since I directed this as being purely for your self-interest, I'm going to tell you the cost right up front. So as I'm talking about this, you can assess whether or not it's worth your time to even listen further. To join the organization, it's $1.75 per pay period, or 42 bucks a year. So we're talking less than the cost of a cup of coffee a month. So with all of this as background, these definitions in mind, let me tell you what SUA has already done for us. We ride on the shoulders of others. So SUA and other success, SUAs and others successfully sued the state of Illinois in 2014 over legislation to transfer the cost of health care insurance to retirees and to diminish retirement benefits. The Illinois Supreme Court found both of these legislative acts to be unconstitutional. Without SUA, this probably wouldn't have happened. SUA also led a successful campaign to defeat an Illinois constitutional amendment deemed detrimental to its members in about that same period. And recently, in the last year, SUA filed an amicus brief in support of the plaintiff's right under the state of, under the state's reciprocal act, whereby transferring from CSRS to a judge's retirement system, the plaintiff, we argued, should receive Tier 1 status instead of Tier 2. And in English, that all means this person actually started employment in the state university system before 2011 and was Tier 1 and became a judge after 2011 and was deemed to be Tier 2. And he went to retire and he found out that he was going to get far less benefits. And that's why he's suing, and that's why SUA is supportive of him. Currently, SUA does a lot for us, whether you're a member or not, and that's why we really would prefer you to be members. They do the following. You'd get regular legislative updates being considered both in Springfield and Washington, D.C. And for those of you that worked in other places beyond NIU prior to this time and paid Social Security, you'd be interested in these updates because H.R. Bill 82 recently passed in a bipartisan effort passed in the U.S. House of Representatives. And what that bill did is basically was going to repeal the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offsets. And what those bills do in their current position is that they reduce your Social Security benefits. So again, this bill passed the House. They're going to try to get it through the Senate, and we'll see what happens before Biden resigns or retires, I should say. And the bottom line here is that you'll get those updates to find out what's going on. SUA is always on alert to defend the Illinois Constitution's Pension Protection Clause. It testifies both legislative committees on our behalf. It also networks with legislators to increase SUAA's or SUA's visibility and influence. We engage lobbyists on our behalf to advocate for our rights as retirees, as well as it advocates, and this is where the Tier 2 folks should be interested, it's advocating for the enhancement of Tier 2 benefits for employees, specifically and most importantly, benefits that at least meet the Social Security safe harbor requirements. So this is what the organization is currently doing, and to keep that in mind, and we'll continue to work on your behalf. Should also know there are two other components to SUA. One is the SUA Foundation, and the SUA Foundation is basically a not-for-profit charity that provides emergency and survivor assistance to its members. It offers scholarships to its members, to the children of its members, and to the grandchildren of its members, as well as to current employees. It provides you professional development dollar opportunities. I must say that those professional development dollar opportunities, people don't apply for those. And so it's pretty easy pickings if you're looking for some money for some research project that you've got going. So I'd encourage you, again, another great reason to join. Another arm of SUA is the SUA Action, and this is a separate arm from the SUA group. It's basically a voluntary, through voluntary member contributions. It makes donations to different political campaigns, as well as provides you grassroots opportunities for campaigning. Our local NIU chapter of the Annuitants Association, we provide coffee hour meetups. We do an annual meeting in June. There are travel opportunities that we promote. We also have an endowed scholarship at NIU, and we also have representatives that sit on many university committees, for example, the University Benefits Committee, as well as the parking committees. So I think membership is a must for all current employees and retirees. It's regardless if you're tier one, tier two, participate in CERS traditional plan, or if you're in the self-managed portable or defined contribution plans, if whether or not you plan to retire from NIU or someplace else, life is strange, and sometimes it will all of a sudden take you to another university or to another arm within the state employee system. So without knowing it today, when it comes time for retirement, this organization would have been fighting for you all the way along. In those areas that you're not getting the defined pension, remember the medical benefits that are provided through our current retirement, and those again are valuable assets to maintain. We're highly regarded by state legislators as being an honest and fair voice on matters of retirement. As I mentioned, the dues is a great value, $1.75 a pay period, $42 a year, and fundamentally there is strength in numbers. And that's why we need you to consider voting, as well as consider joining our organization. It's important you pass the word on to other members that you also represent. Thanks for your attention, and we're going to tell you how you can join.
Can we get those pamphlets passed out, Terry?
Sure.
If you don't know, Chris Doe, who works in the, I think, vice president's office, if I'm not correct. Yeah. She is our liaison to the Annuitants Board here, our chapter. And so one way you can join is simply by emailing Chris at cdoe.nie. You can find her. And she would very delightfully take your membership on the phone and tell you how you can submit your dues and make you a member of this organization. If you're from the old school and you like a paper copy, I've got some, and you can just raise your hand or come up and get some. We didn't make a whole lot of those because we figured most of you would want to do it electronically, but I do have some of those. You can also go to SUA.org, and on that website, I believe there's a QR code that you can take a picture of and go on there and then also join using that QR code. It's also available that you can join for in a way that has your annual dues updated every year without having to send you a reminder. Or if you're like me, you forget the reminder just came in and then you fall into out of the group. So that's another alternative that's just recently been added, really makes it convenient for you to continue on to support this organization and to keep your membership current. We send out two newsletters a year, one in the spring and one in the fall. As Terry mentioned, one of our wonderful perks, if you know Stephen Johnson, who's a retired faculty from NIU, Stephen hosts and leads travel all over the world. They just got back from India and Nepal, and he takes loads of people on these trips, and that is sponsored. We are one of the sponsors of those trips with Stephen. So I don't know if you see that from other places, but if you join the Annuitants, you'll see that's on your schedule almost every month. You get something about upcoming trips. I think in December he's going to take a 2 or 3 week cruise around Hawaii. He calls it his winter getaway. So he takes you to warm places and other options like that. And as Terry said, one of the perks, and it doesn't sound like much maybe, but think about it, 53 chapters in the state, several of them much bigger than NIU, and we have the most members. That speaks a lot to what's going on here, to our commitment to not only our retirement, but to our insurance and to making this organization work for us. So I think that's it. And then there's a handout that came that you're welcome to take. If you want more, these are the end. There's a new one coming out from SUA that I hope to have by the springtime. But you can certainly take that back and share that with some colleagues or share it at a department meeting and pass the word along. We'd love to have 100% of you next time I ask who joins or who's a member of NIUAA. You all raise your hand. Terry, anything you want to add?
No, I thank you for your interest, and hopefully you'll sign up and we'll see your name on the roster.
Are there any questions?
All right. Thanks, Ben.
Wait, there's a question.
Hi, Emily McKee from Anthropology. What, if any, cooperation is there between SUA and the faculty and staff unions?
Say that again.
What, if any, cooperation is there in terms of advocating for retirement benefits and things like that among SUA and the faculty and instructor union?
It represents all the organizations. I mean, you don't have to be faculty to join this. We have staff.
It's a different question. I'm wondering if you work with the NIU union, our faculty union, in any of this legislative monitoring and advocacy.
Yeah, I see. I don't think so.
So at this point, the SUA leader or the executive director does reach out to the union leaderships, and they jointly present when appropriate. So there's that cooperation between SUA as well as the various unions or represented groups within the state. And so it depends on the issue, but they do work together. They're not at odds.
I would certainly say that any member of a union could certainly reach out to SUA and ask to speak with somebody appropriately if they think there's something SUA could do to help appropriately to support a cause or legislation in that area.
I mean, I can give you one specific quick example, and that's the AFL-CIO, because they're the largest union in the state. So when there are issues of joint interest, in particular those that impact state and university employees, our executive director, Brian Sodri, would go to them and to try to present a joint effort in terms of their lobbying efforts. Other questions?
Good questions. Our executive director for SUA just came on board January of 2024, so you can imagine he's making some massive changes and taking his time in it, but also making some things work differently and really building his connections to legislators as well as to organizations in the state.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. All right, so that brings us to item B under 8, which is a human resource services presentation from our Senior Associate Vice President, Chief Human Resources Officer, John Accardo. So if you would like to come up, we can turn the floor over to you.
Good afternoon. Is that on? Everyone can hear me okay? Excellent. Thank you for that. I do see that it looks like it might be snowing outside too. So, yeah, winter has come. Well, good afternoon, colleagues. Again, my name is John Accardo. I'm the Chief Human Resource Officer here at NIU. I appreciate the opportunity to come and present on some stats that I know many of you had requested that you see and hear from HR and kind of what we're monitoring as it relates to one of the many different facets and elements of the university's deficit mitigation strategy. At the end of the presentation, I think we wanted to invite feedback and comments and kind of enter into some collaborative conversation about ideas or thoughts of things that we can also explore for helping our deficit mitigation strategies as well. Before I get into this, I want to just add some context, since I know this is the first time I've presented in this group this particular information, just so that you all have kind of the same foundational expectations when we go through the slides. This is a small piece of the overall picture for all budget deficit mitigation strategies. And so what I'm presenting here today are on four specific areas that at the senior leadership level and at the divisional levels, we've had many ongoing conversations, especially at our monthly leadership meetings, getting feedback and solicitation from campus stakeholders in many different contexts about how we might be able to find ways to continue to find more strategic, to find a more strategic path forward for administrative efficiencies with the work that we do, but also potentially realize some cost savings along the way in that regard. We also identified through some of these contexts that there might be some opportunity to reach some targeted goals that might overall help with our budget deficit mitigation strategies. So while this is one element, I might call on Lori to come up and share a little bit more about some of the other areas that are currently being explored and discussed and feedback solicited on for other areas that we're exploring for this deficit mitigation strategy.
I thought you might do that, so I made a little list. We've had a number of presentations at Faculty Senate since the beginning of the year and even last year talking about some of the different budget deficit mitigation strategies. And so I just wanted to remind us of some of those. Obviously, always looking at student recruitment, student retention. Right now, we're in the process of getting students to re-enroll for spring. We know that that's a really vital goal, because it's the right thing to do to help students complete their degrees, but it's also a financially important thing to do because of the vital role that student tuition and fees play. We made we increased undergraduate tuition by the Higher Ed Price Index this past year. We're looking at graduate and law tuition, which were not increased last year, to see if there is an opportunity and if it would make sense to make increases there. In addition to that, George talked a little bit about energy savings recently with the train partnership and the way that that will provide us with some significant budgetary benefits. In addition to that, he talked about auxiliary sharing. And so the ways that like housing and dining, the way that there's a gain sharing model where some of that comes back centrally to the university to address our budget deficit. Our campus footprint has shrunken a little bit. You probably heard about Laredo Taft, how we're stepping away from the Laredo Taft campus, which will also provide budgetary savings because we won't have the investment there in upgrading some of the systems that had seriously deteriorated, but we also won't have the operations of keeping that campus open. In addition to that, we've really looked at increasing enrollment with community college partnerships and to serve adult learners. You probably have heard us talk about some of those types of recruitment strategies to serve a broader population of students. We've also talked quite a bit in this group about academic efficiencies. So things like reducing low enrollment courses, things like reducing curricular complexity to try and make our pathways for degrees more streamlined for students, but also more efficient from us in terms of a resource perspective. In addition to that, we've looked at financial aid strategic deployment. In fact, this year we have about 200 fewer students enrolled, but our tuition revenue was up more than $1 million. And a lot of that had to do with the way that we deployed institutional aid. George also talked about some of the other institutional aid strategies, I think at University Council, some of you may have been present there, where we're looking at leveraging our AIM High dollars that come from the state of Illinois and to be able to offer housing grants to students where they can get up to $2,500 per year for living on campus to help defray the cost of living on campus. And so then they pay the remainder of that, which helps our budget situation, but also gives students an opportunity to live on campus and reap the benefits that generally accompany living on campus in terms of involvement and access. Accessing resources and general student success. In addition to that, we've looked at some different ways to generate revenue through some of our more entrepreneurial units like outreach, engagement, and regional development and some of the programs that they offer and the way they're pricing those programs. We've also been looking at some new programs. And so we're in the process of standing up cybersecurity degrees at the undergraduate and graduate level. The graduate courses are in the curricular process right now. Our colleagues in sociology have submitted the paperwork for the degree path in criminology, which will also hopefully help us serve more students. And so I'm sharing all of that to say there's a number of strategies that have been going on in terms of addressing the budget deficit. And so John's going to do a deep dive in a particular area, but it's not only this area. These other things that I summarized are also being implemented and ongoing.
Thanks, Lori. Again, just to add some additional context as well, what I'm presenting on is specifically staff related. So it does not affect the faculty, any faculty lines or any faculty or instructional positions. Those procedures and those processes will continue to be followed. So again, I'm presenting mainly on the staff area. Three of the areas are heavily focused on kind of extra add-ons that staff see or can benefit from throughout the course of their employment here at NIU. Our main goal is to really focus on strategic administrative efficiencies and to ensure that we have are meeting our core mission of serving our students in those regards. So I'm going to dive into some of the data and I'll add some context as we go and kind of explain to why some of these areas are being identified and give you some background and some scenarios and some situations that are real situations that have come up as to that can illustrate why this is an area of focus for strategy. We're going to look at overtime, ad pay, extra help, and position activity. And within position activity, there's two specific areas that we pay attention to. Those are job enhancements that are done off cycle. So these are not part of our budgeted process. They're things that happen throughout the year that aren't planned for. Our goal is to be strategic. And so we want to have some integrated process with our budgeting, our annual budgeting process to know what departments and divisions are thinking about restructuring, reorganizations, enhancements, promotions, all those things that go along with those employment lines. And so we'll talk a little bit about what that means and what that looks like and why that's an important and critical area for us to become a lot more strategic with. Also with staffing refills and recruitments, as we look to become more strategic and also focus on how we can have operational efficiency with more administrative processes becoming more automated or more efficient, I'll give some examples of that later on, we need to rethink and kind of reframe how we recruit and staff each of our organizational units with staff. And so we'll spend some time talking about what that looks like and some of those dollars to quantify really what we're looking at on an institutional scale about thinking strategically and how we might accomplish that throughout the course of the year. All the data that's being reported is for the time period of July 1st through November 10th. We look year over year. So we're looking from 2023 to 2024 numbers. And in April, at the monthly leadership meeting and at various other meetings, we began to socialize these four strategic management pillars. It's to slow or reduce the reliance on extra help. Extra help, for the most part and the vast majority, are hired to help expedite or increase efficiencies within processes that already exist. One way that we can realize some potential cost savings is to slow that process down. We recognize that that may mean things may need to stop, be paused, or slow down in that regard, but it is a way that we can potentially realize some cost savings over the course of that fiscal year. Bless you. As we look at extra help, there were 94 units on campus at that point in time in April that were employing only one extra help position. The vast majority of them were to help increase or expedite administrative processes. So again, when we look at the full universal picture of what's happening in the extra help pillar, it is a lot of the time to help expedite or facilitate a more expedient process or administrative function. The next is to look at potentially curtailing non-essential overtime. How I define non-essential is to flip that and tell you what essential overtime looks like. Essential overtime is for our core public safety or mission critical elements around campus. So you think of facilities, building maintenance, those things that require critical infrastructure attention and public safety. Those are essential overtime activities. Non-essential are for pretty much everything else. And on average, we see about $331,000 of overtime being dedicated to those particular activities. Again, these are areas that we are asking employees to help expedite or produce more efficiently paperwork, processing, administrative functions, or procedures. And so asking for us to slow that down, put that on pause, and reevaluate, do we need to do some of those things, allows us the space to do that. Scrutinizing the need for ad pays and desk audits. On average, we spent about $390,000 on the assignment of additional duties or temporary upgrades. And so we wanted to explore, is this really necessary? Again, I know that it is nice to have things done very expediently, but there's a cost to that. And so as we look at least temporarily, is there a way to help reduce costs in this area by reducing the spend in that particular area? Now, before I jump to the fourth pillar here, at no point have I said no. I've not said we're not doing these things. We're asking people to become a lot more strategic with the resources that we have. There is a recognition that we need to have open lines of communication, and there is a recognition that there may be a need for extra help. There may be a need for non-essential overtime, and there may be a need for an ad pay or a temporary upgrade. We're asking our leaders on campus to focus on that being a last resort rather than the first resort. So it's putting us into a different mindset to think more strategically about what can we stop doing that isn't adding value to our mission or to our students, but also places an emphasis on helping with the overall budget deficit mitigation strategies. We'll spend a lot of time in the next few slides talking about that last pillar, but generally it refers to those two elements that I mentioned earlier, which are the off-cycle salary base adjustments, as well as the recruitment process. Are there things that we could potentially explore that could add into administrative efficiencies, i.e. sharing resources or potentially even evaluating whether or not we could blend positions into a higher level classification, add an additional comp to that role, and add additional duties, thinking more strategically about how we manage staffing structures. In the light that we have and will continue to be automating a lot more things and producing a lot more administrative efficiencies. This returns capacity back to our workforce to take on more transformational tasks and assignments. And so we need to be strategic and forward thinking in that regard when developing and reviewing all of our organizational structures. So let's look at some of the numbers. Over the course of the past several months, we continue to see a relatively high use of non-essential overtime over the course of the last several months. However, that said, year over year, we're seeing some pretty good reductions. With the numbers that I presented earlier, if we were to put a scale or a target on this, we're about 17% to our goal there. We are continuing to see a reduction month after month of that non-essential overtime. So we are making ground in that regard. By thinking more strategically, by slowing things down, by putting some of those non-essential things on pause and weaving them into work when it can get done. So we are seeing gains in this area for having a reduction in overtime year over year at this point in time. Same with ad pays. I know that's small, so I'll help kind of explain. But when we look at ad pays, we're really looking at the Fund 02 and Fund 04. All of our other funds' numbers are specifically aligned with auxiliaries or grants. And so we know with grants there are special considerations that are aligned with those. So we're really looking at the 02 and 04 funds, which are state-funded positions. When we look at year-over-year costs or spend in regards to ad pays, we are seeing to date a $251,000 reduction in ad pays to date. That is great. We're making great ground in this particular area. Overall, we have seen a reduction of $545,000 year over year in our ad pay spend. So again, this is a sign that our leaders are thinking strategically and placing resources where they're needed most. And again, we're realizing some of those savings in this budget deficit mitigation strategy. Extra help. So again, I mentioned extra help are those times we hire people maybe to help become more efficient or expedient in our processes. Year over year, we're seeing a reduction of about 109 individuals at this point in time. However, our spend is about flat. We have about a flat amount of spending. What we've seen is to offset some of that elements costs or the cost of that labor has increased in regards to producing our extra help workers and our lines. However, we are seeing, again, some savings beginning to pick up, as you're seeing in September and October. So we hope to continue that trend to begin to see some spending reductions in that particular category. So now we're going to transition to that fourth pillar. And that fourth pillar represents off-cycle increment or base salary adjustments. And those are based on a supervisor's request for a review to reorganize, to enhance, to add in duties, or to, in other way, reorganize their space. To date, since July 1st of this year, we have spent $1.467,856, so $1.46 million in base pay adjustments. These are things that were not planned for through the budgeting process. They came up over the course of the last four and a half, 5 months. This is a significant area that we're paying attention to and asking to put a pause on this particular element of our function. I'll get into some of the reasons why in the next slide, in the next two slides here. But this is an area that we are asking for more strategic thinking. Can we wait from doing off-cycle base adjustments? Is it really needed? Can we potentially shift duties or responsibilities in the meantime while we try to figure out a larger structural, more strategic structure for your organization at that next budget cycle? Year over year, again, we're seeing that we are having about a flat, about a nearly flat total amount or spend year over year, same point in time. That means that we're on track to continue to have what we've seen in the past, which is a large number at the end of that fiscal year. Refills. So what we've typically seen, and I want to add in some stories or scenarios to this, is about our refills. We have been asking and continue to encourage strategic thinking when it comes to replacements for staff. One-to-one refills is what we've been seeing over the past several months. When I get the requests for refills or for when I see things come through requesting a new position or positions to be searched for, I ask tough questions to help add into what we're looking for in the strategic sense. Is it really needed? Can we do something different? And what I often find is that we're pushing forward positions that may have been vacant for several years. And so I ask the question, you know, if these positions have been vacant for several years, why do we need them right now? Can we wait? Can we hold off? Can we reevaluate? Can we potentially do something different or more strategic with these resources instead of refilling a full new position? And so I want to draw attention to this number. In the queue right now, just this past week, that have not been posted for staff, there is about $2.5 million in new payroll that would be added if we were to recruit and hire all of those individual requests. And so the call here is not no, but to say we need to think strategically. Are these really needed? Is there an opportunity to potentially share resources interdepartmentally, intradepartmentally, or across divisions? Are the positions absolutely necessary for our core critical missions, or are they nice to haves? All of these questions we're really asking our leaders and our supervisors to take back to their working groups and to their departments to see if there might be a different way. Again, we're not saying no, but we're asking that the yes should be one of a last resort. These are all ways that we can continue to think more strategically and to really think about how automation and more administrative efficiencies might change that position in the months to come. So again, I'm sharing with you this information because they are big numbers and they do play a role in continuing to grow our deficit. And so these are areas that we're focused on encouraging more strategic thinking and administrative efficiencies in those regards to help with our overall budget deficit mitigation strategies. So kind of pulling this all together, what we've been working with our leaders on campus and certainly have been asking for feedback in many of these particular areas is that because of those particularly two last slides, we need to place a temporary pause on the job enhancement and unit organization requests, along with the temporary pause of non-essential hiring. What we are looking for is establishing working groups to come up with protocols and procedures that might help us get to a point where we're thinking very strategically about those two particular elements. And so some of those ideas that are floating out there that I'm sure you've heard from colleagues, and again, we're socializing these ideas and concepts and soliciting ideas for more, but also trying to get what will work if we do go down a path of creating a position control environment for staff. What does that look like? How might we gain share from that and potentially realize savings to the Central University to help with the deficit mitigation strategy? Same with a realignment of having all of these requests occur on the annual budget cycle. Would that work? How do exceptions get vetted and evaluated and approved if that's needed? Because we know there will need to be exceptions. So again, we're not saying no, but we're trying to put some protocols and procedures so that more analysis can be done before we get to that yes point and see if there is a different way, a different path forward. The other and last option that we're focused on developing working groups is to ask the question, is there an opportunity now to look at shared service models for commonly provided services to campus departments? And so we're setting up working groups and calling out for volunteers on those particular groups, and we'll be establishing them over the next few weeks to look and see if this is a possibility and to begin looking at what those options might be to help with administrative enhancements. When you have common core functions that are able to be centrally deployed, you realize administrative efficiencies. If someone is on leave or on vacation, you have someone that might be able to step in right away. There's also deep knowledge, and training is more efficient in that regard as well. So all of these are being considered, but I did want to at least share with you some of the data that we're seeing in those four areas that we had identified in April, and certainly ask for any type of solicitation, comments, feedback, questions on any of those.
So. Well, thank you, John. And as Therese walks up to the mic, I just want to say I appreciate the willingness to share the data, to come and share what's going on, because while none of this is directly tied to faculty like salaries and positions, it does change the work that we engage with. It helps us understand potentially some of the frustrations we have, and also ways if we find recommendations, and I think that's one of the things we'd like to solicit from the group, either here or afterwards, it can help alleviate the burden of the staff or the support for us or for our students if we can identify areas for those efficiency gains. And it also helps contextualize when something is slower than we're used to or something like that. But Therese, I'll.
Thanks, John. And I start with, I do recognize the struggles that are going on. And I'm the broken record in the room, and I know that. You started, and Ben alluded to this too, that it doesn't, you know, you're talking about staff. I am a faculty member. I'm a 12-month faculty member, so I have a really weird, you know, position. I lost the administrative support in my department 5 years ago, and it has never been brought back. Guess who does that work now? Me, as well as a couple of my colleagues. We lost our extra help person we had, who we got because we had no other assistance when this started in the summer, and now guess who does that work? So these changes do directly impact us, not just, you know, not just staff. And our staff, we have for years said, are the backbone of the institution. And we're talking about ways to spread the work around for people who are already significantly at, you know, they're at max. I can't say, you know, people are at 150% because you can't be, but people are at their max and they're exhausted. And you hear that in people's voices. You know, people keep doing their work. They keep getting this work done, but you hit a wall. And I've heard this topic and multiple versions of it. And every time I hear it, and I know there are new people in the room, and then there are people like me, like, we've been here for so long. I know you're trying to get out of this, but at what point do we just break? Because we can't pass it on to somebody else. We can't, we need an actual, maybe we don't need $3 million worth of new positions, but we might need $2 million worth of new positions, legitimately. They haven't been doing it, you know, I haven't had someone for 5 years. It takes its toll. So the people that have had those positions open, they're possibly at breaking point or past. And I need that lens to be kept on things, because it's frustrating. And I mean, I know you have a hard job. I know you, Lori, have a hard, you know, I'm not saying this is easy, but I have to get up and say it impacts every single one of us. And I can't even imagine asking, you know, operating staff that I work with to take on something else. And that's why I take on things, because I can't do that. And so just had to say it again.
No, I want to thank you, and I really appreciate you sharing that feedback. And again, thank you for the feedback. And it is taken well. I hear that at meetings I go to and do the same presentations. And this is heavy, hard conversations to have when we're looking at ways in which we can help with our overall financial disposition. But I think part of where you're going to get tired of me saying the words strategy and strategic comes into play is, I think we really need to think, how can we create more efficiencies? And I think a really good example of this is what we're working on right now in HR, and that is our time and labor In 2021, the university went out and explored how can we become more efficient in the work that we do. And one of the top tier items that was identified was timekeeping. We still, in 2024, still maintain timesheets by paper. We spend $60,000 printing timesheets in HR every year. It takes up 150% of two employees in HR, and we actually quantified it in 2021 by doing a survey. 15% of our admin support's daily routine is consumed with chasing people down for time cards, making sure that they are correct, entering in those paper time cards into an Excel sheet that then gets uploaded into a file, then has to get validated and then approved by the supervisor. That then gets redistributed back to the department so they can then upload all of the signed timesheets so that we can go in and actually audit and look at the comments to see what different work groups apply in each of those particular settings so that we can then manually apply all of the different pay rules to that person's salary. We've contracted with a company to help us automate that entire process. And so this will return within a few months' time, 15% time back to our staff. And so where we think strategically, we know in a few months' time, 15% is going to be returned. And so now we can really focus on some of the work that needs to get done and potentially realign how we structure our staffing strategy to provide that administrative support that you need in a way that we know is more strategic and focused on those more transformational things. So I really appreciate you sharing that feedback, and it is well taken. I appreciate you bringing it forward. I share and empathize with you in that regard as well. But I think we really need to focus on some of those strategies in that automation. I don't know, Lori, there were a few other automations that came online recently from the academic affairs perspective that I know we're starting to see some of that return in those savings as well.
Probably the newest efficiency is we have a system called curriculum. If any of you are on curriculum committees, you've been trained on that to know that in the past, our curricular processes were done pretty manually, and we had staff who were oftentimes, formatting and then distributing those and then getting back the feedback and making the corrections and then, submitting those to the next level. And so now that we have the curriculum system, everything is in that one system, which makes it a lot more efficient, easier to track, and it's a lot less of that sort of manual, printing things out and distributing things that used to take up a pretty significant time for some of our staff members who support either department, college, or university curriculum. Another space that we've implemented some efficiencies are with centralized room scheduling. Used to be that individual staff members were locating rooms and scheduling rooms and making sure that the room would accommodate the size of the class. And so now that we're doing that all centrally through the online system, that's another time savings. Those are two specifically in academic affairs that come to mind.
Again, I think once we have known what these are, and our conversation yesterday at our monthly leadership group was focused on this, is knowing that these efficiencies are coming, how might we think more strategically about utilizing the staffing resources that we have to really find a way to support all campus areas in a more transformational means?
Hi, I'm Jim. I represent operating staff. So I get two things. The first is, I will say, while the conversations have been hard and frustrating, it is true that they are conversations, and we have gotten positions that had not been up for a while posted. So that has happened. I appreciate that it's not just a no. At the same time, I think one of my major frustrations is that there was this conversation about restructure efficiencies, change things, combine jobs, and now there's this conversation about, well, we might pause that. So as we look, like, it's difficult to be told, hey, you need to restructure, but also maybe we're not going to let you restructure. So that's just my feedback on that. I realize that you're not there announcing that that's officially there yet, but that's a hard one. It's like, how can you combine jobs? We also might not let you combine jobs. How do you add tasks to and just increase compensation instead of rehiring? But we might not let you do that. It makes our planning a little harder.
Pardon?
That's the thing that I've heard from lots of people in operating staff, where largely we, complain about you guys mostly.
Hey, I appreciate your comments and feedback. And again, I wouldn't be here if I wasn't truly interested in hearing what you all had to say. And so I do appreciate the comments and the feedback, because we need to get it right. And getting it right means We have a complex organization that has many different facets. So again, I just want to reiterate a line that I said earlier. I'm not saying no. What we're asking for is to kind of tap the brakes, put a pause on this, and in the context of this pause that we're implementing, is to talk to your division leader, because they are the ones that can determine which is essential and what needs to be pushed forward. So while we're pausing, I want to kind of also add in the caveat that we want to have open lines of communication. So contact me directly, contact your division leader, say, John, I just can't do this without this position, and it will be considered. You know, that's all part of this process, is I don't know what is essential. You do. And so I will ask tough questions in our meetings, but at the end of the day, it's your decision. And so we need to have kind of that open lines of communication, add a bit more analysis behind what we're doing, and achieve the results that we know we can do.
Good afternoon, Kurt Thurmeyer. I've been teaching and studying budgeting for about 35 years. I worked in the Wisconsin State Budget Office for 4 years, so I know about position controls and so on. And I appreciate that all these things can improve efficiencies, and that's great. But when you keep using the word strategic, and you don't do strategic thinking, to me, that's a problem. We spend $1 million on two people in our salary base, the athletic director and the football coach. $1 million across our operating staff, who actually make the university work, is a strategic decision. So the leadership can talk about strategic, but we're not asking big questions that are strategic, like, can we afford to be in the football, athletic, entertainment business that we're in? If you look at the SIC code, football is entertainment. We spend a lot of money on entertainment, and yet we're asking people to have 5 years of not having an administrative assistant. We're asking department chairs to do clerical work, putting together fundraising letters, which I did for 13 years, because we don't have staff to do it. So I find the word strategic overused and under actually appreciated.
Thanks for the feedback.
Hi, my name is David Valentine. I'm from psychology. I think that there's a problem that we share, and it's that we're relatively underfunded, but we have a public mission. And because we're not getting funds that are adequate to do the work that we're being asked to do, it creates a tightness, a workload that's maybe somewhat unreasonable for faculty, for staff, for administrators. And I think also that that same stress is felt down at the student level. I think, though, that the faculty are uniquely charged with protecting the academic rigor of our programs. And I think that there's demands on us that eventually translate into doing less for our students. And so I just want to remind the faculty that that is our charge. When we're asked to reduce curricular complexity, for example, imagine a major in which every major takes exactly the same course. That would be the lowest level of curricular complexity. But we shouldn't allow that, right? So I just wanted to call on the faculty to protect academic rigor.
David, I appreciate that comment. And in reducing curricular complexity, I don't think the goal is to create a step-by-step program. Through shared governance, faculty do have oversight and control of curriculum and the assessments that are used, the student learning outcomes. And so I just want to confirm that in reducing curricular complexity, we're looking at things like prerequisites, we're looking at things like students get caught off on a path and then can't take another course because they can't get a prerequisite that's necessary for a course. Is it really necessary or not? I think there's opportunities to look at things like that. I think there's also opportunities to look at some of our programs that are very strong in overall numbers, but when we look at particular specializations, they might be very small and it's difficult to offer those courses. So I think as we look at curricular complexity, that's what we're trying to look at, making a pathway that's more accessible and completable, I don't know if that's a word, more able to be completed by students, not necessarily, you know, taking it and having it be a lockstep sort of curriculum that everyone marches through in the same way. We know that, you know, electives and choices are really important for students as they complete their degrees to make sure that they're being prepared for their goals and for their futures. So I just wanted to clarify that point, and I definitely appreciate your feedback to remind us to keep that in mind as we move forward.
Go ahead.
Oh, hello, Shane Sharp, Sociology. I'll probably be very inarticulate about this, but I have the feeling that short-term solutions to panics, you know, that we're kind of having with this budget can lead to long-term problems, because I'm of the belief that a strong staff, strong and vibrant staff leads to strong and vibrant faculty. Be very productive both in research and teaching, and that leads to a strong and vibrant student body, a university where students do want to come to. And if we basically kill off these positions for strategic reasons to save money in the short term, it might lead to long-term negative consequences that perhaps we don't consider trying to fix the problem in front of us. So I just felt the need to say that.
Thank you for that. And you and I are aligned there. You know, I completely agree with you. And I think some of the items that I had on that previous slide are trying to get at that point. And again, we're here to talk about, you know, feedback and ideas and finding solutions. And some of the ideas that are being discussed right now is that position control. Is that an opportunity to potentially find a way to help manage through? Is having, you know, that realignment of our budgeting process to include reorganizations, a more strategic way for us to see on a holistic picture all of the changes that are happening within divisions. So yeah, I absolutely agree with you that finding ways for long-term solutions and viability are critical and important.
We'll have one more comment for now.
Hi, Jason Axton, Communication. Salute you doing the hard work, cost savings and so forth to the others who have spoken. I would chime in and add, I think you'd get more buy-in and more support if you also were more transparent in some of the initiatives that the university just does. So for example, one of my bread and butter courses is a basic graphic design course, and so I use Adobe products pretty often. I was amazed to learn a few months back that the university had sprung for entire access for everybody at the university. I can't even imagine what an extraordinary expenditure that was, which I would argue is probably not necessary. But I'm somebody who uses that stuff every day and heard about it out of the blue. And the partnership, which means a contract, I think you should be more transparent and disclose the dollar value of the Together All system. The initial contract with Braven was $4 million. So there's a lot of money going out that people sort of learn after the fact that I think could maybe be more examined more closely. And then the last thing, I hate to say this, and thankfully I'm not in charge of it, but the new room assignment system that Provost Piper, Elish Piper mentioned, at least in my department, everybody hates it. It's a freaking nightmare. It kicks out rooms all the time. We have to start over. I know one person who has an ADA compliant situation who's constantly having to rearrange it. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
So I think, I mean, I appreciate the conversation. Yeah, okay, go for it.
Yeah, Brendan Swetho, Political Science. So a question, since we're dealing with human resources, what does the analysis look like for the rest of the human resources, faculty and administrators? I was shocked to learn that We are spending about a quarter of our budget, $100 million a year on top-level administrators. $100 million a year on top-level administrators. I just don't understand that. And I wonder what the process looks like for gaining efficiencies in top-level administration.
I'd need to run that number again, but I know there was a presentation. Wasn't there a presentation on that at the previous or a few months ago?
Yeah, last time you came, I believe, right?
Yeah, that we did a top-level analysis of the funding around, and I don't know if that's an accurate number. I can go back and look at that particular presentation. But again, you know, is part of this presentation, administrative is wrapped into staff, and so that is part of that analysis that I presented earlier.
So where's the top level administrator piece of that analysis?
I would need to get those numbers to you. And again, I think we did present on that a few months ago. So I'll ask Ben maybe to remind me and I can take a look at that.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, John. And I think the takeaway is, as I summarize it, one, I think the fact that we're able to have more tangible conversations and specific conversations and informed conversations is a good thing as we continue pushing forward. And I know President Freeman and her senior administration are committed to sharing a budget website with more information on it. And this is a march towards transparency, towards better principles. I know it will not be the final point, but it will give us a chance to continue pushing for more transparency and more accurate reporting so we can understand and contextualize it. I appreciate the willingness to come here and hear from us. And I think the point about defining what our strategic priorities are in a public way, I think that is something that I will be taking away from this and pushing to understand better exactly what those strategies are, rather than strategic meaning reduction, maybe strategic meaning investments in certain ways, and trying for myself to better understand it and for us to, as a collective, better understand it as well. But I do appreciate the comments and the elevation of concerns and the impacts of how, while this is staff focused, it impacts our faculty, it impacts our students, it impacts the health of the institution. So I appreciate the conversation today. And I do know John is open for conversation, or you can share it with me if you'd prefer, and I can advocate or have those conversations as I can be supportive in this role. All right, so that brings us to new business. We have one item for new business, which is the approval of the search committee structure for the dean of the graduate school. I just want to note, as Provost Ellis Piper comes up, that there is a typo in item A, where it should be not per faculty senate bylaws, it should be per NIU bylaws. It's correct in the packet on page 6. And with that in mind, actually, before we go, John.
That number was senior admin.
All right, so the number was for senior admin was $2.7 million as of fiscal year 2023. So my guess is it's categorization differences potentially of what a senior level administrator is, but that was the number from 2023 to go back to that. So what we'll need for item A to approve this is we'll need a first, a second, and then Provost Ellis Piper will lead the discussion on this item, and then we will take a voice vote to approve the search committee structure. So if I could have a first or a motion to approve the search committee structure for the dean of the graduate school. Thank you, George. A second. Thank you, Jim. And so now I'll invite Provost Ellis Piper up to lead the discussion and answer any questions if there are any. Again, and you can see the request on page 6 of the packet.
So currently, Dr. Jessica Raymond is serving as the acting dean of the graduate school. And so in putting together a search committee, we looked at the structure of the search committee that was done about 4 years ago. When was the last time that we were looking for a dean of the graduate school. And so within that, the search committee chair would be Robert Brinkman, the dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. We always have a fellow sitting dean serve as a search committee chair. And then we would have 7 faculty members, 1 from each of the academic colleges. And in doing that, we would want to make sure that we had representation that related to PhD and other doctoral programs, master's programs, and also graduate council. In addition to that, we would have 1 faculty member from the library. We would also have 2 graduate student members. We would have 1 staff member from the graduate school. We would have 1 administrative member representing academic affairs, and we would have 1 member from Faculty Senate who would represent shared governance and be a liaison back to Faculty Senate. So that is the structure of the search committee that is being proposed today.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments about the structure of the search committee? All right. So then what remains for us is to take a vote to approve the structure of the search committee. So all in favor of approving the search committee structure as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? All right, so that passes. That then brings us to item 10, which are reports from councils, boards, and standing committees. First up will be the report from the Faculty Advisory Council to the IBHE, and Dr. Tiffany Puckett, who is our representative to that group, will share a report.
Hello.
Oh yeah, there we go. Oh, okay. Good afternoon. I do have a brief report from the most recent Faculty Advisory Council meeting, which was held this past Friday at Rosalind Franklin University. They hosted the meeting. We had a great welcome by the provost, and we took a tour of their simulation lab for their medical school, which was very interesting. Some of the quick updates that we still have a library liaison position available on the Faculty Advisory Council. So if someone is interested in that position, you can reach out to me so I can provide information related to that that position. The legislative liaison told us about 2 potential, we were talking about 2 bills that are going on right now. There is now a House bill that pretty much mirrors the Senate bill on the funding bill that's been the higher ed funding bill that I talked about last time. And then there's also a pending bill that is focusing on tier 2 pension plans. They're trying to make some changes, proposing some changes to the pension plan that are going to allow it to be a better plan to get more benefits for tier 2 retirees. There is still currently no faculty member on the Illinois Board of Higher Ed. Faculty Advisory Council has submitted multiple names to IBHE, and the chair at IBHE has said they have submitted that name to those names to the governor's office multiple times, but they still have not assigned a faculty member to IBHE. IBHE liaison reported that public universities are at their highest enrollment in 8 years. There's been an increase in African-American, Latino, and transfer students, and that overall, there's an overall increase in community college enrollment at 7.4%, and an IBHE representative, David Smalley, will be talking to us more about going deeper into those numbers at our December meeting. At our business meeting, we continue to discuss the important role of librarians and as faculty members, and FAC will not be signing the Carley statement that was issued related to the importance of library faculty members, but we will issue a position statement citing administrative rules and directing it back to that statement. We did have the opportunity to have the chair of IBHE come and present, and he had a few some things that are worth speaking about. He talked about how they're in the process of wrapping up their duties related to providing assistance with the drafting of the higher ed funding bill, that now they're really more of a technical advisory role, but he did indicate that there are still negotiations going on related to the Senate bill and the House bill version of the funding bill, and they're still discussing how endowments will be used in that funding formula. He wanted to have a discussion around workplace development on campuses and how that's working. I did share that Northern Illinois University has a Center for Governmental Studies. And under that center, we do have a workforce development and economic analysis service where we have assisted with workplace development plans, including more recently working with Illinois State Board, Illinois State Department of Commerce to come up with a 5-year plan. And then we did ask him about why there's still no faculty member on IBHE, and he just reiterated that they sent the names up to the governor's office multiple times. There's a concern because the student member has recently been appointed, but we still don't have a faculty member on that board. Coming out of the working groups, there is going to be a prior learning assessment survey that will be emailed to me in the upcoming weeks. And so I will need to get that survey out to the person who will be responsible for filling out that prior learning assessment. And then our next meeting is December 20th on Zoom. Are there any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Tiffany. Up next is the University Advisory Committee to the Board of Trustees report. When they met, there were updates that were shared about the progress on the higher education funding bill, which Tiffany just referenced. They received a presentation from one of our faculty members, Lindsay Harris, about her work and her work with graduate and undergraduate students, and that continues the trend of the Board of Trustees wanting to understand how faculty research provides opportunities and supports for our students. The Board of Trustees received their annual informational report related to the oversight of the academic programs at NIU. That report typically only contains information on those programs which have gone through their eight-year review process with IBHE or the relevant cycles of review per disciplinary and college accreditation standards. During that presentation, in response to it, Trustee Butler asked if it was possible for the Board of Trustees to receive annual updates on the health of academic programs via an annual report. This was affirmed by other members of the Board of Trustees. And in the public conversation, it was agreed in principle to add a university goal in alignment with adding an annual program report, which would help the Board of Trustees better understand the status of programs on campus. In those public comments, it was suggested by President Freeman and Provost Elish Piper that there be a shared governance component to this, that faculty ought to have a voice in the development of the measures. Since that meeting, I have had conversations with both the Faculty Senate Steering Committee and with the Academic Planning Council about what those measures might look like, what those reporting structures might look like, and how we can ensure faculty have voice in the determination of the measures, but also in contextualizing them when they go in front of the Board of Trustees. And I've also been in conversation with Provost Elish Piper and will continue to work to ensure faculty have a voice in this process going forward. We have received updates on the financial situation in the university, and it was clear from pretty much every subcommittee conversation that the Board of Trustees has an expectation for that balanced budget by fiscal year 26. And this was included during the annual performance review of President Freeman and the setting of expectations for this upcoming year. That's the report I have, unless anybody else wants to add anything. All right, so then that brings us to, there's no report from the Baccalaureate Council and no report from the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee. I'll be giving the Social Justice Committee a report. So the Social Justice Committee has continued to meet monthly and been engaged in a few key tasks. First, the Social Justice Committee has been asked and has provided feedback on a set of self-reflection questions, which will be shared with academic units and colleges so that they can use them if they so choose when reviewing their promotion and tenure policies and guidelines that they will be engaged with in this upcoming calendar year. The second task, the Social Justice Committee has identified focus areas for the remainder of this academic year, which will guide the work into the future, into upcoming academic years as well. Within that, the first priority is to learn from faculty about opportunities for improvement and as well as barriers and challenges that they are facing here at NIU in order to develop a data-informed approach to future efforts of the Social Justice Committee. So there will be invitations and opportunities for faculty to share perspectives and to participate in efforts to better understand ways to improve improve campus. And then the next meeting of the Faculty Senate Social Justice Committee will focus on developing that approach and how to best learn from faculty on campus. The second priority will be to continue work on supporting promotion and tenure across campus so that the whole system of promotion and tenure from the academic unit through the Board of Trustees reflects the principles outlined in those Faculty Senate bylaws. And that is the report from the Social Justice Committee. We have no report today from the Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee. Manny, I think I saw you. I don't know if there's a report from SGA. No. Operating Staff Council, looks like Jim has a report for us.
Previously, I shared that we did a priority survey out to our constituents, and what came back for what is most on the mind of the operating staff is university financial status, job upskilling, reskilling, and training as we go forward, and then mental health. So that is what Natasha plans on kind of using to guide our work going forward.
Thank you, Jim. And no report from the Supportive Professional Staff Council. So that brings us to informational items, item 11. A through O are the standard minutes and policy library. There are, I believe, three policies currently open for comment in the policy library. Please do feel free to look at those and leave comments. Our next meeting won't be until the new calendar year, January 22nd. And then the final announcements are the commencements announcements, and I'll share those when I send my summary as well. But do please attend if you are able to. That brings us to item 12, which is adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn the meeting? David is first, a second. Second, thank you, Dan. All in favor of adjourning the meeting, say aye. Aye. Opposed? All right. Thank you.